Welcome to Track 10, The Inevitable Architect, a phase-by-phase guide to green building. And I'd like to start this introduction with a quick little story. I was sitting in an airport a little while ago, and I was telling some family members about some projects my company, Lorax Development, was looking at with a very impassioned and innovative green architect. This guy seemed to have an answer for everything, and as I said, had a passion that went with it that really impressed me. So as I was talking about these projects, I mentioned too that this architect seemed to have experience way beyond his years. Seems he's done twice as much work as a man his age could have pulled off. That also he was a speaker, an author, sits on various boards, is an academic, and on top of that is the founder of his own firm, Organic. As well as too many credits and awards really to list now, after I got on the plane and sat down, I flipped open a copy of Dwell magazine, and there he was, two-color, glossy, fold-out spread with Eric looking lovingly at some bamboo trees. And I just thought to myself, besides all those other things, he's also a green fashion model. So, Eric Corey Fried.
Wow, I think I'm going to cry. What Mike didn't know is that in that photo in Dwell, when I'm looking up at the bamboo tree, that there's actually a naked monkey's butt right there. Thank you all for coming. Thank you all for crowding in. I'm sorry that it's such a small room, and I'm sorry about the registration. I'm sorry about all that, and not that I really had anything to do with that, but... as Mike said, first and foremost, I'm an architect, and first and foremost, I love design. But about 6 years ago, I realized that I was doing all these other things that didn't really have anything to do with architecture and didn't really make any money and kept pulling me out of the office and away from the staff and away from our clients. And but yet I felt that they were important. And finally, I realized that the end unto itself is not architecture, as I kind of always thought it was, but actually the end unto itself is to make the world a better place. And that ultimately became our new revised mission statement for Organic Architect. So when I started the firm 9 years ago, I thought if I can just speak passionately about what I believe, that it'll repel a lot of people, which it does, but it'll also hopefully attract a lot of people. And really, I think that's probably the most important thing that anybody can do, is just to speak passionately about what they believe, and hopefully good things will follow. So to that end, in addition to being an architect, I also teach sustainable design at two schools, and I lecture all over the place, and I'm on all these boards. And I do it because I think that that's what the world needs. And I'd like to encourage you all to do the same thing and do what you think the world needs. So that being said, we don't have much time, so I'm just going to jump right into it. Today I'm going to use this as an opportunity to talk about how we approach sustainability and how we explain it to our clients and how we explain it to contractors. 50 years ago, a man named Bucky Fuller, hopefully most of you have heard of him, wrote dozens of books all about design and the planet. And in it, he defined sustainability as the effective applications of the principles of science to the conscious design of our total environment in order to help make the Earth's finite resources, not infinite, mind you, but finite, meet the needs of all of humanity. And again, that's not just rich people, it's not just white people, it's not just Americans, but all of humanity. And we must do this without disrupting the ecological processes of the planet. Now, I know that's a big mouthful, right? But remember, Bucky Fuller at the time was dismissed as kind of an eccentric lunatic, and they thought, oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about. And now, 50 years later, we're really starting to appreciate what a genius he was. I mean, after all, this is the man that did the math to figure out how we could house, clothe, and feed everybody on the planet. And he didn't keep it secret. He published it in a book. And he did exactly what I'm saying, that we must be the change we wish to see in the world, that we must do what the world needs. 50 years later, the United Nations came up with their own definition of sustainability. Simply put, developing the needs of the present without sacrificing the needs of our future. Can anybody read this? Should we turn the lights on? You want the lights out?
Yes.
Lights off, please. You don't want to see me anyway, trust me. Ooh, is that better? It's an all or nothing thing, people. What do you want to do? Your eyes will... All right. So in looking at this UN definition, developing the needs of the present without sacrificing the needs of our future, how then does that apply to you and your work? How does that apply to us as designers? So I'm going to give you a little quickie intro here. Being a teacher, I always like to define our terms. So let's define a few. The first one, eco, comes from the Greek oikos, which means house. So in this case, economy would be house management, and ecology would be house knowledge. And it's funny how rarely we link those two words, economy and ecology. But in truth, as you can see by their very nature, they are indeed linked. And they're linked because nature has the perfect economy, right? Nature wastes nothing, balances everything. Nature doesn't have recessions. And maybe if we understood better the economy and ecology of nature, we could understand our own economies much better. And all of this is because in the last 100 years, a lot of really bad stuff has happened. We've lost 50% of our wetlands, 50% of our forests, 70% of our fisheries are all gone. And I'm not saying this to scare you, and I'm certainly not saying this to make you feel guilty, but I'm saying this to put things into context. Because if you look at this graph, that red line indicates where we are now. And you can see that this devastation is actually planned to get much, much worse. So this is a chart. I don't know if you can read that or not. But this is a chart of, quote, very serious environmental concerns that normal people have. You know, not biologists and scientists. People like you. People like our clients. And surely this shouldn't be a surprise, right? It's destruction of the ozone layer, water pollution, air pollution, all that other stuff, all that doomsday stuff that you hear about all the time. And then if you look here, the chart on the left there, those gray bars indicate consumers' interest in all things green, all things sustainable, all things organic. And then those black bars indicate corporations' response to that. And those of you who have ever taken an economics class knows that that difference is what we call an untapped market, right? So we're really on the verge of this. This is really a nascent emerging field, even though even though for the last 15 years I've been saying, oh, 5 years from now it'll all be different. And then, of course, if you look at the industry sales trends, they're going up, 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 and away. And they keep on going. But you don't need these fancy charts to tell you that, because in truth, all you have to do is look in the media. Right? Any newsstand will give you an indication that clearly there's something going on with our planet. Clearly, people can no longer feign ignorance that there's no longer an environmental problem. I'm not here to sell you on the why. You should already know that. Maybe that's why you're here today. Today we're going to talk about the how. Now I know you can look at this pile of magazines and you can think, oh, that's hippie trash. We can dismiss that. But now we have new magazines coming out, like Plenty, geared towards the hip Gen X sexy environmentalist. But it's not just these specialty magazines either, because if you look, here's Time Magazine. Time Magazine does 52 issues a year, an issue a week, right? Last year, 32 of the 52 issues had to do with the environment. Can we really say, oh, I didn't know there was an environmental problem? How can we continue to do that? And then, of course, my head almost fell off when I saw this, when Vanity Fair dedicated an entire issue, the green issue, printed on, you know, oil-based, non-recycled paper. But still, to me, this is a sign that we've reached a tipping point. We've reached the point of ubiquity that we've known for a long time is going to come. But really, what does any of this have to do with buildings? Most of us here are designers in some form or appreciate design. And unfortunately, all of this has a lot to do with buildings, because buildings are the worst offenders of them all. Buildings of the world are more responsible for this problem than cars. And we're always pointing at the automotive industry, bad cars. But if you look at the carbon emissions, 45% are coming from buildings, not from cars. Buildings of the world consume 40% of the world's energy and materials. 25% of our wood, 17% of our water, all into buildings, not cars. So clearly, architects, designers, contractors, engineers, we're all in a position to affect great change on the environment. And so far, all of it's been fairly negative. To illustrate the point, this is the United States population, about 4.5% of the world's population, right? Well, this 4.5% is consuming 34% of the world's energy. And this 4.5% is consuming 65% of the world's electricity. And this same fat, bloated, ignorant 4.5% is producing 30% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. How can you look at this and think, oh, this makes sense, we can continue this? It doesn't. Especially now as China and India are getting some of their own wealth and emerging in population and in stature, and are now saying, we want to be like America. What a horrendous thought. China's now just realizing that the 400 million people they need to house in the next 12 years, if they were to live the way we do, they would kill everything on the planet. This, of course, is the polar ice caps in 1979, and this is it today. I don't know if you saw the cover of the Chronicle this morning, but California's going to war on global warming. They did a study a few years ago, and they said to designers, do you think you've got an obligation to offer sustainability to your clients? Do you think you're responsible? And 83% said, oh, yeah, sure. And only 37% actually do. And quite frankly, I think most of those 37% are lying, because if you look, green building is now only making up an estimated 8% of all the buildings being built. But I firmly believe that every building does make a difference. And I firmly believe that each snowflake in the avalanche pleads not guilty. And that we can't keep continuing saying, oh, one more toxic building won't matter, one more this won't matter. It does matter. So we have to stop being our little snowflakes in the avalanche. You remember Vitruvius? An ancient Greek named Vitruvius in 27 BC wrote the 10 books of architecture, required reading for all architecture students, whether they read it or not. And in it, Vitruvius said, and I know it's hard to read, but in it, Vitruvius said that all architecture should have firmness, commodity, and delight. Remember that? In our modern-day terms, firmness, commodity, and delight would translate to being functional, aesthetically pleasing, and then responsible. And that's a great word, responsible. That's the word that we use with our clients. We don't use sustainable. We don't use ecological. They get kind of scared when we say that. They think that word sounds expensive. But responsible, they understand. If you think about it, it makes sense. You know, they pick up their kids at soccer practice and they're responsible. And they pay their taxes and they're responsible. And every now and again, they remember to pay their architect's bills. And they're responsible. So in talking about this new aesthetic, that's what we're really doing. We're taking responsibility for what we're bringing into the world. And we may not like all the answers that we get, but at least we're going to question them. At least we're going to talk about them. Because in the near future, hopefully near future, the word green architect will be redundant. Saying green architect will be like saying structurally sound building. It just sounds silly. It'll be like saying fast sports car. We didn't have this term green architect 15 years ago when I started. We just had, you know, building. And I think in the near future, it'll go back to that, because all buildings will be green. And this, we firmly believe, is inevitable. And if you look at the charts, that, of course, will indicate this. The U.S. Green Building Council did a study 10 years ago. Buildings constituted $53 billion in the construction market, 5 years ago, $200 billion, and then last year, $800 billion, estimating about 8 to 9% of the construction market. So given all of this that I just said, this context, given that there's this massive environmental problem, given that everybody's aware of it, and given that architects are responsible for most of it, given all of that, what is the problem? Why are we still having conferences like this that need to educate people about it? Why aren't all buildings already green? Well, we've identified that there's two main problems to this, and they seem to be the two largest obstacles that are holding people back. The first one is that most people don't know how to explain sustainability to their clients. So I'm going to give you the crash course, the 5-minute overview of how we teach it to my students, and how they in turn then teach it to their future clients. The first thing you need to know is that every material, every product, every single thing has what we call a life cycle. And there are some parts of this life cycle, the first one being embodied energy. These little chairs you're sitting on, as uncomfortable as they are, I'm sure, are not plugged in anywhere. But I assure you, they have energy in them, embodied into it. Someone had to find all the materials, someone had to source them all, collect them all, gather them, mill them, process them, manufacture them, assemble them, ship them here. And all that is embodied into the design of this product. And normally, all of that is ignored by the designer. The other thing you need to understand are byproducts. And byproducts typically have this negative connotation, I know, but byproducts are the leftover products, both good or bad, that come from this embodied energy, this extraction, manufacture, installation, transportation. And then the last thing you need to know is waste. And waste is this man-made word. It's this label that we made up to make ourselves feel better about things that we're really not smart enough to know what to do with. Nature doesn't have any waste. Nature recycles things in endless loops of nutrients. But we don't do that. We throw things away. Does anybody know where away is? I used to live in New Jersey, and I used to think New Jersey was away. But we all actually do know where away is. For those of you not from San Francisco, you can come visit away. It's on 101 South, right by Candlestick Park. It's called The Dump. And it has the birds flying overhead, and it stinks. So really, you have to understand that this paradigm doesn't work, and ultimately, there's no such thing as waste. So going back to this example of life cycle. Life cycle is looking at any material, any product, anything, from its extraction, its manufacture, its transport, all the stuff that happened before, through its use, and then into and including disposal. What do we do with it when we're done with it? And this is what it looks like. Hopefully you can read that. Everything starts in some form as a raw material, whatever it is, goes through some sort of supply chain process, through its manufacturing, through delivery and receiving, and through installation. All of that occurs before the designer really gets their hands on it. And lots of times, designers will say, I don't have any impact on that. I don't have any say in that. It's not true, but I'll get to that in a minute. After all of that, it finally gets into use. So the architect, designer, contractor actually get their hands on it. But even within that part of the life cycle, there's elements that we ignore. Does the thing need to be powered or plugged in? Do you need to kill a baby seal every now and again to power it? What do you need to do, right? So that's part of the maintenance cycle of it. Then, is it made to be durable? Is it made to last a long time? If it breaks, can you repair it? A lot of things are designed not to be repaired. We call it capitalism. So even within that part of the use, we look at that. And then, of course, after whatever length of time, whatever it is, when we're done with it, we throw it away, right? Most of what we do ends up in landfills, where it's over-designed and then takes 100,000 years to leach toxic materials into the soil. And then we eat the food and the things that grow out of the soil, and then the toxins end up in us. And I guess the joke's on us. What then is the case for designing a bottle that's going to last 100,000 years when it has a usable life of maybe 6 months? So maybe we can redesign it to break down and be biodegradable and feed the soil. Or maybe we can design it to be recycled or reused. So at each of these stages, as a normal part of entropy, energy goes in and energy is lost. It's just the way things work. And at each of these phases, byproducts are given off. And sometimes we reuse the byproducts. Sometimes we're not smart enough to know what to do with them, and those are given off and lost, and those become waste. But since most of us as designers really only focus on that middle bit, that part of use, and we ignore what happened to it before and what happens to it after, how then can you look at the life cycle? And not just focus on use, but focus on the before and after. Does anybody have any ideas? And I put stooges in the audience to throw out answers, so don't make me call on them. Well, one idea would be that you know, if you want to use a wood floor, maybe you don't fell trees to get it. Maybe use reclaimed wood or sustainably harvested wood. Or something like bamboo, where bamboo grows like a grass and we cut it and it continues to grow, and you can sustain that. And if you were to clear cut it, then it wouldn't matter because the bamboo is rapidly renewable and grows back within 5 to 7 years. So maybe that's one way, but we'll talk about more in a minute. But what we need to do is we need to look at this life cycle and ask these questions of every single thing we put into the building. We need to ask how this life cycle can not only inspire better designs, but also protect our resources at the same time. Any ideas? No? All right. You're shy. Now, anytime we have these byproducts left over and we throw them away and we think of them in terms of waste, we call this process cradle to grave. And a lot of people call this industry. And in fact, a lot of our businesses are based on this model of throwing things away. And anytime we think in these terms of disposal and throwing something away, again, that's cradle to grave, birth to death. And I'm trying to sound ominous here. And again, most people call this industry. But if we change that paradigm, if we look at things in a different light and accept the fact that there's no such thing as waste, and we think in terms of reuse, and we think in terms of this entire life cycle, then we have cradle to cradle, birth to rebirth, ad infinitum. And this is a very simplified example of cradle-to-cradle thinking. This is the Mirror Chair by Herman Miller. It's based on the Aeron Chair, which some of you might even have in your offices, right? And what I like about this example is that not only has it won design awards on its own merits, artistic merits, which is good, but also it's part of this cradle-to-cradle thinking. This chair, the plastic, is not made from oil like most plastics. This chair's plastic is made from corn. So if you throw it away, the corn will break down and feed the soil, and that's a good thing. But it's not designed to be thrown away because Herman Miller will gladly take it back, and it comes apart in less than 15 minutes, and it's 96% recyclable, and they'll make it into more mirror chairs. So they're not recycling and downcycling it into, you know, speed bumps. They're going to make more mirror chairs out of it, and they can sustain that over and over and over again. And that's cradle to cradle. Problem number two is that even on its best day, environmentalism, bless its heart, is not a black and white issue, which is unfortunate because a lot of people like black and white issues, don't we? Democrat or Republican, black and white issue. Sith versus Jedi, black and white issue. So how then do you look at all these competing things? You know, you go to the store and they say paper or plastic. And you think, God, plastic is recyclable, but it's made of oil. And paper comes from trees, and that's a bad, or is that a good thing? And we're going to keep the trees, but we want to, so suddenly you're faced with this philosophical dilemma. And in truth, the answer is neither. Bring your own bag, right? But we're not offered that choice. And in sustainable design, we have multitudes of these conflicting choices. So do we pick the thing that's biodegradable, or do we pick the thing that's recyclable? Do we use the old appliances because they're already there, or do we throw those away and then pick brand new fresh appliances that are more energy efficient? For some of these, we have answers, but for most, we don't. And it really depends on the nature of the project, depends on where it's located, depends on the budget, all those things. So how then do you look at these things and make a discernible answer? The biggest case in point is concrete. Is concrete a green material? Does anybody know? No. Yes? Anybody say yes?
Can be.
Can be? Well, let's look at the life cycle of concrete, shall we? So on the one hand, what's concrete come from? Well, sand, water, stone, Portland cement, it's all natural. And then that's good. Technically, it's recyclable. That's good. Incredibly durable. That's good. Can be made on site. That's good. Sounds like a green material to me. But its chief ingredient, Portland cement, it's mined out of the earth, heated to 5,000 degrees, gives off all this greenhouse gas. That's bad. So is concrete a green material? Kinda. Better than most? Well, people hate that answer. They don't really like it too much. So at best, environmentalism is really shades of gray, or shades of green, if you want to be funny, right? And that's the biggest problem. How then do you make environmentalism appear as a black and white issue so that way your clients, normal people, can understand it? So the best example I have is actually a kind of a goofy one, which sometimes make for the best examples. Do you remember a few years ago the dolphins were getting caught up in the tuna nets, right? And everybody started screaming, "Don't eat tuna, don't eat tuna. The dolphins are dying, Flipper's dying." And everybody came to the aid of poor little Flipper because Flipper's very cute, right? And unfortunately, the tuna contingent was out that day because nobody came to the aid of the tuna because the tuna had been dying for years in the nets. But tuna aren't cute, and we protect cute animals, and since Flipper's cute, we're going to protect Flipper. So what happened? Well, the tuna industry said, can't be done. Can't be done, I tell you. We can't change things. It's too expensive. It'll impact the consumer. So what the consumers did is they said, don't buy tuna. They took a very complex issue, shipping and agriculture and canneries and distribution, all that other stuff that none of us really understand, and they simplified it to, don't buy tuna, Flipper's dying. And what happened was that overnight, tuna sales plummeted. Isn't that great? And suddenly the industry that said it couldn't be done suddenly changed their tune and said, I think we can make it, change things. And now you can't buy tuna that's not dolphin safe. So that's how you take an issue that's very complex and make it into a black and white one. So going back to our example of concrete, if really the only environmental impact of concrete is this Portland cement, what if we use something else? Well, it turns out that we take this stuff called fly ash, and we can replace a certain percentage of the Portland cement with this fly ash, and it makes the concrete more workable. It takes a little longer to cure. But what is fly ash? Well, fly ash is this leftover soot from the burning of coal. in this country, 85% of our electricity is produced by burning coal. And we're left over with tons and tons of this nasty stuff called fly ash. And normally we dump it in the ocean. And when we dump it in the ocean, the chief ingredient in fly ash is mercury. And suddenly you've got mercury in the fish. And then we eat the fish. And again, the joke's on us. But what if we then took that fly ash and poured it into this chemical mixture of concrete? It turns out that it reacts with the concrete and becomes completely inert and safe. It makes the concrete stronger, costs less because Portland cement's so expensive, and reduces the environmental impact of concrete. So is concrete a green material? Well, fly ash concrete's a green material. And those are the kind of semantics that we have to play with every single material that goes in the building. Is a wood floor a green material? Well, reclaimed wood floor is a green material. The way we sell this to our clients is that we break it down into three levels of financial commitment: finishes, systems, and structure. But it's not just a financial commitment. There's also a bit of an emotional commitment as well. Your clients need to trust you. The first one, finishes, is easy, right? You're going to essentially play the substitution game. For every material that you normally specify in a building, I guarantee you there's a greener alternative. And what we found is that as the economies of scale, these green materials goes up, their price comes down. And since we put oil into all the toxic materials that we normally use, their price just goes up. And we think of that as the cost of doing business. But now green materials are the same price or less than their traditional counterparts. Second is systems. Now, systems take a bit of a commitment on the client's part because they're an upfront cost that you normally wouldn't have. And the way that we deal with that is we calculate their return on investment. So if someone wants to put solar on their house, we figure out, well, how much electricity do they use? And figure out that in 6 years, 5 months, 9 days, and they pays for the solar. And that's how we then sell that to the client. And then lastly is structure. And structure is a big emotional commitment, not just on the behalf of the client, but on the behalf of the contractor, as Michael will tell you. Because when you say to someone, oh, we're not going to build out of 2x4s, we're going to build out of straw. And they look at you like you're insane. Oh, and by the way, the walls aren't going to be 6 inches thick, they're going to be 24 inches thick. That freaks people out. So what we do is we expect that they're going to freak out. So we anticipate this. And then what we'll do is if we're using a product like insulated concrete forms or some product thing, we'll have the sales rep come and educate the contractor on it ahead of time so the contractor feels more comfortable. Because both client and contractor are going to have this resistance to something they've never seen before. Given that we have all these disparate choices, what we've done is, in our office, we've set up a series of priorities. And that way, when we're faced with multiple choices, we then can look at this list of priorities, and these are shown in order, and we can pick the lesser of two evils. So in other words, if I have a choice between two materials and I can't pick one, if I have a choice, I'm going to pick the natural, non-toxic one first. Because I think it's important not to kill your clients. So I set that as a priority. You might have a different priority. And then next we go through low embodied energy and then picking something sustainably harvested, then something recyclable or biodegradable. And then all the way down to that last one, durability. And believe it or not, durability is really an aspect of sustainability. Because if you build something to last a long time, you don't need to keep producing more of it. So it's worth mentioning. Since we have these new priorities about how to pick things, we also have new goals. In addition to the standard goals of picking something that's, you know, on budget and picking something that's on schedule and hopefully something that's beautiful, the architect now has these new goals to choose: improving the indoor air quality, improving water efficiency, making every building a passive solar building through select siting, reducing the energy use, materials and resources, and then that last one, community building. And again, community building is an aspect of sustainability because people like to, for some reason, sequester themselves from everybody else. So what we do is we change that and force them to interact. And I believe that every building can foster community, everything from a single family house up to a giant hotel. So some of the ways we do that are we have a client now, it's a single family house, and they put a disco ball out on the street. For those of you visiting San Francisco, it's at 20th and Lexington if you want to go see it. And what happens is people come and they dance underneath the tree, underneath the disco ball, and that fosters community. And then we have other clients that put out little art boxes and they change out the art or change out little sayings in the box, and people walk by and laugh, and that fosters community. Other people put out dog dishes and that feeds the dogs as they walk by. Some people put out benches. And all those things foster community, and all those things are ultimately a bigger picture part of sustainability. And then lastly, there's these two obstacles that I need to mention, because if I don't, perhaps nobody will. The first one is that beauty is not exclusive of sustainability. And what does that mean? It means that just because a building is a green building doesn't mean it has to look like a mud hut or a rice cake. In truth, it can look like any freaky thing you want it to look like. As I tell my students, design whatever you want, and we'll show you how to make it green. But don't think that you're stuck in this weird look. True, a lot of green buildings have been that way. True that I've done my fair share of those things. But they're really not related. After we developed these sustainable design curriculum for Academy of Art and UC Berkeley, I then took it to other schools and said, here, take it, use it for something. You know, we spent a lot of time on it. Why shouldn't you use it? And a lot of schools are very receptive to it. But one school in particular, who I probably should name, said, the dean said, oh, no, we're not interested in sustainability. We're a design school. And I said, I don't understand. this is here, just take it, use it. And he said, no, we're a design school. And this who's on first thing went on for hours. And then finally I just gave up, and luckily the dean's, he's no longer working there. The second thing you need to realize is the cost is not tied to green materials. You can have two identical looking buildings side by side, one done with traditional, what we call toxic materials, and then one done with sustainable materials. And then how can you possibly compare the two? One building wastes energy at every turn. One building wastes water at every turn, flushing clean drinking water down the toilet, ignoring the rainwater that falls on the roof. The other one saves the little bit of energy it does use, maybe even produces its own energy, conserves water, uses responsible materials. How can you possibly make that argument? Oh, this one cost $5 more. To who? And I'll show you what we mean by that. Here's a chart from the USGBC again. 10 years ago, green building averaged an upfront cost, not a life cycle cost, just an upfront cost of about 7%. Even back then, I had said, 7%, it's nothing. Isn't that worth it, getting a building that has all these extra features? 5 years ago, it was 5%, and then as of last year, according to the USGBC, about 1-0%. Now, mind you, that line is going to continue across the x-axis, and green buildings will be cost less to build upfront. But this is just upfront. This isn't even talking about all the benefits that come with it, and I'll get to those in a minute. So how then do you sell these ideas to your clients? Well, I'm going to go through 10 quick ways of how we do it. Now keep in mind that these don't work on every type of client. You know, you've got a single family homeowner, that's one type of client, and then you have a developer who is somewhere in Dante's ninth circle of hell, and that's a different type of client, right? So I'll make the distinction. The first is to stress the life cycle cost rather than the upfront cost. And what do we mean by that? Well, when the client says, yeah, I'm kind of interested in solar, what does it cost? I always say, oh, solar's free. And they go, what? I go, yeah, it's $22,000 upfront. And then after you consume electricity for 6 years, it's free. And then continues being free, actually producing money, income after that. And then people go, oh, I see what you're doing. And I think, what am I doing? I'm showing you that we need to change our perspective. We need to reframe the argument and not just focus on this upfront thing. Next is to stress the environmental benefits. And I mention this upfront because this is actually the lamest, weakest, most pathetic argument that we can make. Nobody cares. For 30 years, this is the argument we made. Mother Earth is dying. The trees are dying. Butterflies are dying. Do something. And everybody said, get right back to you. What this is this is icing on the cake. After the client has already chosen their thing, for whatever reason, because of its looks, because of its cost, because of its features, then they enjoy the environmental benefits. And I see it all the time, because the clients go, see this floor? This is all reclaimed. This used to be a barn. And they pat themselves on the back, and isn't that great? But that wasn't the reason they got it. They got it because it was $7 a square foot or whatever, you know, whatever, it looks good. So I mention this only because it's a good after argument. Next is to stress the social benefits, and luckily there are numerous ones. They found that in a room just with natural light, not like this room, but in a room with natural light, that students do 14% better on the SAT. They found that if they had fresh air, it goes up to 22%. Is that of value to somebody? If you're the Board of Ed and you're building a school, is that of value to you? I would think so. Next is to stress the health benefits. And unfortunately, we keep getting sicker and sicker and sicker. Asthma used to be the seventh leading chronic illness in children. Today it's number one. Autism used to be, in the last 10 years, the incidence have gone up 20-fold. We spend 80 to 90% of our time indoors, and then we coat the walls with toxic oil-based paints. And we wonder, God, why are we getting so sick? It's kind of obvious. Next is to stress the performance benefits. And again, these are numerous. The simple way to look at it is that if you have a building with natural daylight, the lights aren't on all the time, and you're not changing light bulbs all the time. And we translate these into bottom-line benefits for our clients. And again, if you're a developer and you're not going to retain ownership of the building, you don't care about any of this, I know. But if you're an owner at all, then this matters to you. And if you think about it, it makes sense, because you're going to spend a hell of a lot more on the operation of the building than you ever did on the construction. The building itself lasts, you know, that process lasts for 2 years maybe. But for 100 years, they have to operate this thing. Next is to stress the occupant satisfaction benefits. And again, there are numerous ones. They've discovered that in a green office building, that absenteeism goes down and the productivity goes up. That people call it sick less because they don't dread it as much. Walmart did a study and found they were ripping the roof off of a store in Lawrenceville, Kansas, and they covered the roof with skylights. And they found that sales in the skylight portion were double that of the non-skylight portion. And they found that the cash registers that extended into the skylight portion rang up twice as many sales as the non-skylight portion. So what did Walmart do? They're putting skylights on all their stores. That's another story. Next, we talk about return on investment, this one dealing with energy savings. That although solar panels might have a large upfront cost that might be prohibitive to some people, what we found is that just doing simple things like doubling the amount of insulation, something like that can pay for itself in a matter of weeks or months. Is that a value to somebody? The next return on investment is on maintenance savings. Since we spend so much more on maintaining the building, it turns out that any upfront investment you do make in green building, UC Berkeley did a study and found that it pays for itself 10 times over the life of the building. Do you know other investments that pay for themselves 10 times over? Maybe Google. And then the last return on investment is on tax incentives. And luckily, we're here in California, and we're blessed to have so many. We have Energy Star credits and solar credits. And if any of you are having trouble finding these, come up to me afterwards, and then I'll email you the list, because everybody should know about them. And unfortunately, we need these incentives. They're actually quite effective, but we need them in order to get some people, especially developers, to start building green. But this might be the difference between a green building and a non-green building. And then lastly, my favorite is the one that we're already doing all the time as designers, and it's the simple one. We're essentially just falling in love with the beautiful. There are some green materials that are so beautiful, so innovative, so unusual, that we can just set them in front of clients, and we don't even say what they are. We just say, what do you think about this for your countertop? And they go nuts. And then after they've already done that, we then say, oh, by the way, this is recycled glass. And then they go nuts for it, and then that's the story they tell. See the countertop? It's all glass. But why make the argument if we don't have to? You know, green building's not a pariah. We don't need to hide it away. We can sell these things just on their own merits. They're pretty enough. What time is it? I'm going to zip through these case studies really quickly. But this is just some of our work, just so you can see it. This is a condo in San Jose. This is at 2nd and Santa Clara. It's under construction now. We weren't the architect on this. We were the hippie on it. The city of San Jose required that it be LEED Silver. And the developer, of course, saying, well, whatever they need, we'll just do it, thinking that it's just another obligation. And in the process, we discovered that in the course of doing LEED, I made several suggestions to the design. Initially, they'd given me this kind of concentric donut plan with a courtyard in the middle that would be 5 stories deep and essentially guarantee that nobody would ever spend any time there. So I thought, what if we shift the masses around, move things about, and the goal for me was to get light from 2 directions in every building, in every unit. So that's what we did, and then made 3 small courtyards that would be used rather than 1 big donut hole that would never be used. In the course of doing this, we were able to fit 5 more units in for the developer, and suddenly that was a value to the developer, and now he's really sold on green building. This was a toxic site called a brownfield, and they had to excavate out 40 feet into the ground to treat the soil. And since we had this big hole in the ground, I said, well, why don't we put the parking garage down there? And what that does is it reduces what's called the heat island. In other words, instead of this hot, icky concrete structure, that's underground and keeps it cool. Now here's a little street. This is a second street. So I didn't design it. This one's actually in San Francisco Magazine this month. That's a little plug. This is an addition in 25th and Lincoln in the Sunset. Those of you from San Francisco know the Sunset is one of the foggiest areas of the city. And they wanted to do an addition, and I felt that an addition would block off any little bit of remaining light that was coming into the building. So instead of the typical two-story thing, we did a one-story thing, two cubes that are intersected, and then it creates a little outdoor room that lets natural light into the existing building, and then the two additions. One is an office, and one is a master suite. And then the client painted triangles all over her living room, so I made the windows triangle-shaped. And at the time, that seemed like a good idea. And then just as a matter of course, because we do this on all of our projects, we used non-toxic paints, non-toxic adhesives, earth and plaster on the walls in some rooms, reclaimed wood floors. The whole thing's oriented to the sun and not to the street. Here's the office. This is an example. Boy, that's really hard to read, isn't it? This is an example of some of the consulting we do. Half of my time now is spent teaching other architects how to be green. And I feel for the next 5 years, maybe, that'll be something I'll have to do, and hopefully I'll never have to do it again after that. But the architect, in an afternoon meeting, this is what came out. He handed me this massing diagram, and he said, here, make this green, but you can't change anything. That was the best part. So just in a brain dump, I just started sketching all over it very quickly. And then what we found was the two towers are actually condos. So 14-story towers. And, of course, they face direct west and south. So they would have gotten pummeled with light and heat. So we put what's called a thermal chimneys on each side. It's a solar shading device. And then between the chimney and the building, air travels up because heat rises, and then that passively cools the building. And then put light-colored roofs on the building and then cover them with solar hot water heaters because condos consume a lot of water. And then down below at the bottom is a 5-story office building. Cover that with a green roof so that way people could see it and see green instead of a roof. And then to the right is a 3-story parking garage that was all open air. And then since it was such a big, ugly area, we covered that with a pergola of solar panels. So you park underneath these solar panels that also shade your car and keep it cool. And that seemed like a good idea. And then, of course, all the parking lot and everything is all porous paving, so that way water doesn't erode the side and go anywhere. And then gave preferred parking to Prius owners. Well, nobody drives electric vehicles, so I thought that was a good idea. And then put in bus shelters, and then those little kiosks are for community announcements. And then just laid this piece of trace over it, and in 5 minutes did a sketch. So I draw better than that, just so you know. And then this is what we came up with in an afternoon. And this, to me, was a good example of how green design can influence the design to make a better design, but not necessarily have to change what the architect had come up with. This is a project in Redwood City, existing garage that we kept because there was no point in tearing it down. The client's a little nutty, and he loves light. He's nuts about light. And he said, if I could live in a glass box, I would. So that's what we made. It was a glass box. And then the roof eventually evolved away, and then I thought, well, what do we need a roof for? So the whole thing is a glass box. And the whole thing is oriented to the sun, not to the street. So the south and western exposure is a big thermal mass wall that stores in heat all day. But the rest of it is all glass. And when birds fly overhead, you see their shadow pass along the ground. And then the big chimney goes up through the roof, and then a spiral staircase goes around, takes you up to the master suite. And then windows around the chimney at the top, and then small windows at the bottom allow for when air passes over the building, it creates a negative pressure and sucks air and creates a natural what's called passive cooling. And you don't need air conditioning in Redwood City. And then the little bit on the left, that's a kitchen because I needed a place to put cabinets. This is an addition in Bernal Heights. This is on Richland Street. The client, this is a lovely, just lovely, lovely client, and that's her favorite color. She's got shoes and pants and everything that are all that color. So that's what we made. And this thing, again, is oriented to the sun, not to the street. So it's a 3-story addition. Each level of the addition is essentially one big open space. She likes a lot of big open space. And I always ask my students, can they tell which way is west? And of course, the trick is that you can see the western exposures covered with that brise soleil, that those things. And those are just stalks of bamboo, and each one's been angled slightly differently, so it creates that weird undulating effect. And then, of course, non-toxic paints, non-toxic adhesives, water catchment, solar on the roof, and kind of cool window treatment. This is actually in Santa Fe. This is kind of some of the mud hut work that we did. This building's out of adobe, genuine, honest to God adobe, mud blocks, and that's a little gate called a zaguan. And then here's a little interior shot. It's a very dark photo, I know, but that's the dining room. This is another house in Santa Fe. This is concrete floor with radiant heat in it. And then that window at the end locks its gaze on the mountain peak, you see? So the whole house is oriented to the views. So as you walk down that hallway, all you see is Las Truchas Peak. And then off to on the bedroom wing, it turns and does the same thing with the other peaks in Santa Fe. And then as you turn right and go into the living room, here's the living room. And all that Navajo stuff, that's all the interior designer. I didn't do that. It's not my taste. All the beams are reclaimed, by the way. Because it's adobe, we used earth and plaster on the walls and covered the plaster with beeswax, which gives it this gorgeous shine. This is a house that I did. This was for charity. This is for the designer showcase house, and this was in San Rafael, and each designer gets a bedroom. So I got the teenager's room. So this room, that bed is suspended from cables off the ceiling. The floor is eco-timber reclaimed wood that Dan at Eco-Timber was nice enough to donate. And then those stairs are reclaimed wood train, railroad ties. And they're cut to be an alternating tread staircase. So it's the full rise and half the run. And it's completely code legal, except for the handrail that we took down after the inspector left. but otherwise, it's legal. And then the walls are covered with a lime-based plaster, which is like painting with concrete. And then non-toxic paints and recycled glass handrails and all this other stuff. This is a house in Mill Valley. It's in the hills, so I thought, why don't we make the thing into glue lamps, and then we'll ship the glue lamps up, and I thought that was a good idea at the time. And then it's essentially a giant tree house. This is like the Redwood City House, straight lines that are each angled differently to create a curve. So it's a way to get curves without a curved budget. And then in between the wood is polygal, which is a polycarbonate thing that's recyclable and also blocks greenhouse heat. And here's another example, straight lines again, angled to create curves. And this is an addition, actually, and that curved bit encloses a courtyard that you can kind of see. And again, there's the polygal. And then lastly, this is a fireplace, and that's very dark, too. But fireplace, all natural materials, blah, blah, blah. So, sorry to rush through that, but we're running out of time. So I give this presentation to both architects and normal people. So this is the point in the presentation when I can actually pick which route. Are there more architects in here or more normal people? Raise your hand if you're an architect. All right, architects it is. So really the question is, how then do you implement these ideas in your office? So I'm going to give you a little action plan that you can hopefully take away with you and start doing in your office today. The first is to include this into your existing peer review, whatever that is. I don't know if you've got a monthly staff meeting, if you have a weekly thing, whatever, if you have an office newsletter. Offices all seem to have some form of this, but include this. In other words, if it gets measured, it gets managed. So if you start talking about sustainability, you might actually do it. Even if the person in charge of sustainability says, the sustainability committee has to report that there's nothing to report, right? Even if that's what you say, in my mind, that's better than nothing. Because at least you know it's there and it's pressing you. Next is fill the – a lot of architects say, I want to be green. And I'll say, okay, well, how many green products do you have in your library? And they'll say, none. And to me, that's the first place to start. Fill your product library with green finishes. If you have them, you might actually use them. If you need a list of suggestions of what green materials you want to have, we actually have a list on our website that we give out to people. So if you just go to organicarchitect.com, you can find it there. Next is to stop asking the client permission to do the right thing. They come to you because you're a professional. They don't ask you to design something that meets building code. And they don't ask you to design something that's structurally stable. And they don't ask you to design something beautiful or innovative. All of that is kind of implied in the contract between an architect and a person, right? So why then are you waiting for them to say, please build me something that won't kill me and is non-toxic? Please build me something that won't waste energy. I find that a lot of clients are usually surprised when they learn what dangers lurk in their home or office. And they think, why didn't somebody do something? Why didn't the building department stop it? So, it's not right to laugh. They expect you to be a professional. So I think this is implied in the territory. Next is to bring green to the attention of all your clients. From this day forward, everybody in this room is a green designer. Meaning that you should start talking about it to your clients. Even if you have to say, listen, this is what we're interested in. This is the direction that we want to move in. Do you want to be our guinea pig? And you'll be surprised that a lot of clients say, yes, we've been interested in that. We didn't know you did that. We thought you only built these ugly, toxic buildings. Next is to offer green as part of your basic services. Whatever your contract is, however that is, put a little piece of boilerplate in the contract that says, and of course, we're going to make this as green a building as possible. And I know for a fact you'll get some clients that will object to that and want it stricken from the contract. But I think you'll get a lot more that'll say, oh, good. And you do this not because it's trendy and not because it's cool to do, which it is. But you do this because you generally care about your clients. You do this because you want to build the best building you can for them. Next is actually a trick. I learned long ago that clients have this wonderful ability to only pick what's in front of them. So if they ask you for a wood floor, they don't say, oh, give me pergo wood floor, which is filled with formaldehyde and toxic materials. They don't say that. They just say, I want a wood floor. So what we'll do is we'll show them, 8 or 10 wood floors. All of them will be sustainable. And they'll only pick from that bunch. And then maybe later they'll say, oh, I was at Home Depot and I saw this pergo for $1.40 a square foot. And I'll say, you don't want that. That's all formaldehyde and toxic stuff. That's bad. You're going to put your kid in a room with formaldehyde? And they go, oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Next is to start now to create green standards in all of your projects. We have a list that we call the list of no-brainers, and that, too, you can get from our website. And essentially, this is a living, breathing document that we keep expanding and revising. And this is a list of all the green things that we do automatically on every project. So that way, as new staff comes in or new projects come in, you know ahead of time what to do. And then finally, you're not doing this alone. Building, whether you like it or not, is a team sport. And what you'll find is a lot of allies in this project team. So if you explain these environmental goals to the entire project team, what you'll discover is that your mechanical engineer is actually an expert at passive solar design. You'll discover that your structural engineer is an expert at, hopefully an expert at fly ash. And what you'll discover is that even the contractor, there's one right there, even the lowly contractor, even the contractor will probably be your best resource and your best ally in this, especially if you're starting to use materials that are new. And very often, as we found with Mike, very often they will come up with things that you never even thought of. Don't do it all yourself. Okay. How am I doing on time? Oh, perfect. Okay, so some parting words. Again, to reiterate the United Nations definition of sustainability, developing the needs of the present without sacrificing the needs of our future. How then does this apply to design? How does this apply to architecture and your work? Next, one of my favorite quotes that I mentioned before, that each snowflake in the avalanche pleads not guilty, and that no longer can you continue working on these projects that are damaging to our environment, damaging to our health, and not taking responsibility for what they're doing. Each of you can make a difference. Each of you has that ability in you, and I'd like to use this as an opportunity to encourage you to do that. And then lastly, a quote that's actually the title of our business plan. It's from Gandhi. That you must be the change you wish to see in the world. And the fact that you're here today at this conference is indication of that. So thank you all for coming to that. Thank you all for listening.